our speaker, Bobby Joe Brown, Alpha.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bobby, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Bobby.
My sobriety date is July 10th, 2011. I have a sponsor, and she has a sponsor, and I have had the absolute honor and privilege of sponsoring quite a few women in this program. I am an alcoholic, but through the grace of God and the gifts that I have received in this program, I do consider myself recovered from this terrible disease. Recovered, when I say that, I don't mean cured. I mean recovered. I'm fully aware, and you'll know from my story when I get through it, that if I do not continue to practice what I'm supposed to do in this program, that, you know, that I have that ability to fall back directly and fast right back to where I was from the get-go. So I guess I start my least favorite part, what it was like. I grew up in Staten Island, New York. We were very poor. Grew up in a pretty bad neighborhood. I went to Catholic school and went to Catholic church every Sunday. For me, it was very structured and rigid that way, but thing is, we had every kind of abuse and every kind of addiction was a part of my upbringing in my family. When my mom had me, I have an older sister and two older brothers, and they one of them absolutely not afflicted with this disease, and he's not the norm in my family. My mom was an addict, and my grandmother knew that she could not take care of a baby on top of these three young children that she already had, so the decision was made that my grandmother would raise me. When I was nine, my grandmother passed away, and this is when I found out the dynamic of my family changed. Who I thought was my sister was my mom, and you know, my brothers and sisters, who I thought were my niece and nephews, were actually my brothers and sisters. So for a nine-year-old, that was kind of really hard to swallow. And, you know, I think they did it in a way that it would be like, all right, we know you lost your mom, but you actually still have a mom. And I was really close to my mom, so I guess they thought everything was going to be okay. But again, they were all really afflicted with this disease, drug addictions, gambling, and it was a rough go coming up. I did really well in school, except for that one year when my grandmother died, and then I threw myself into it. And I was really still young. I was very, very bright and talented in school, and the thing is, when I was 12, I had the opportunity to take a hold of my first fifth of vodka, and I swallowed that bottle like a regular 12-year-old would drink a juice box, and I drank like that from then on. Every time I got a chance to be around alcohol, eventually, you know, other substances, out of respect for the program, I will leave it at that. I have addictions of every kind myself, and no matter what it was, I would do it. That's the kind of addict I was. So I'm a complete blackout drinker. I blacked out that day, and I thought it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I totally got out of myself. I didn't like who I was. I didn't like my family situation. I did kind of still have this love for school, and like I said, I was brought up Catholic and going to church every Sunday. I always had that struggle with doing the right thing, but at the same time, I wanted out of my existence from that point on, and I found a way to do it, so I went all out with it. And through high school, that's pretty much what I did. I partied as hard as I could, whenever I could, whenever I had the opportunity. I got a job early so I could afford to do it. And I don't know, like, I could not take you to my high school today and show you where it is or my way around it, or I have no recollection of it, and I got skipped a year in it. incredibly somehow managed to get a full scholarship to college. And being that I was skipped, I was still very young. So I just turned 16 when I graduated. I turned 16 in April and had this full scholarship. And I thought this was my big way out. And my mom, who I know today that my mom did the best she could. She never had any kind of help with all this. She came from a very abusive relationship. And doing the best she could, she still believed that girls were to grow up, get married, and have babies. And deal with these abusive men in their lives as long as they could possibly put up with it. And so she took away my way out. She said, "You're too young." She was afraid for me to go into Manhattan, which is where I got my scholarship. And being 16 and pissed off, I decided that, fine, I would not go to college. I would get married and have babies. So at 17, I went to the bar, because at that time, at 17, in Staten Island on Bay Street, if you were pretty and looked a little older, you can go into a bar and do whatever you wanted to do. So I met my first husband at this bar. He was 25 years old, and I thought he was the greatest thing in the world because he had a job. So this is our big plan, was for me to get married, and we were to start having these babies. At some point along the way, I decided that I needed to go back to college, and I started picking up classes here and there. And my husband was not afflicted with this disease, but he did have a pretty bad gambling addiction. So we kind of went along that way. I had three kids really fast. They're 13 and 14 months apart, and one is my little guy. He's not so little anymore. He has cystic fibrosis and cerebral palsy. Right before I started having them, I was 19 years old, and my dad was killed by a drunk driver. Now, my family being the family that they are, and I don't know who's Catholic here, and if you know how the wakes and all that go, there's usually a big party after. So everybody was wasted at this funeral. Everybody drove home, even under the circumstances. My uncle, had we not been connected, being from Staten Island and knowing all the cops, that you know, he would have had a DUI and possibly could have killed somebody. So that's just kind of the insanity when I think back on it, and how we all thought that that was okay. And, you know, we really did. Like, everybody thought that it was okay to go to this funeral. And we were devastated. I was young. He was young. You know, and this is my stepdad, but he was the only dad I knew. So it was tragic. A year and a half later, my sister was having her fourth child and went into a coma and died after having a miscarriage. And as my children were being born, one after the other, my mom, I was taking care of her, she had cancer, and she passed away. And it was just a really rough time. And that was any part of my life that I was trying to get together at that time. Everything seemed to just be caving in around me. I had a bit of a nervous breakdown, and you know, I was stuck with no parents, no sister, two brothers who, you know, I thought maybe we'd get closer because of all this, but, you know, they're 9 and 10 years older than me, and we just never did, and it was all very sad and tragic. And I used it for the excuse to go, again, all out in my addiction. I don't know how I managed to function and raise these kids, especially my son, because he was very sick and always in the hospital. And I had times where he was in the hospital for weeks at a time, and I would bring the vodka to the hospital, thinking that it was my absolute God-given right. If I'm going to be stuck in the hospital with this sick kid that God seemed to think was okay to give me with all this going on, that, you know, I had every right to get liquored up at night in the hospital. And again, the insanity of the disease. I don't know how I thought this was okay. I don't know how I got away with most of this. I have a couple of DUIs in my story. The first one was when I was 27. My marriage fell apart when my youngest was two. So they're 2, 3, and 4, and now I'm a single mom. So I migrated from Staten Island across New Jersey with my first husband. We ended up in at the shore, and then Bound Brook and Glen Gardner, and it's just I kept going. And eventually I was going to move to Pennsylvania because it's cheaper, and I was single. But, you know, my husband's like, you can't cross the border. And I'm like, fine, I'll move as close to the border as I can get just to annoy you. So I ended up in Alpha, New Jersey, which is right near the Delaware River, crossing Euston. And so I'm in this little tiny town of Alpha, and it's from coming from the city to going to Alpha was just a really big adjustment for me. The kids were still little. They were just starting school. They have a nice little school there, so I'm thinking I'm mom of the year, single, taking care of these kids, always had a job. And that's where it really became delusional to me, because I figured if I was holding a job, taking care of these kids, everybody's fed, then I'm good. They're good, I'm good. The problem with all this was I would work all day, put the kids to bed at 6 at night, and that's when mommy's time started. And I would drink until I blacked out and then passed out and then wake up the next morning and do it all over again. And, you know, at that time, thinking I was the mom of the year, I started to, you know, I came to find out later that the problem with all this was I was absolutely not present for my children. So in my delusional thinking, I was doing the best that I could do for them. Meanwhile, I was really not there for them, even in the hospital with my son. I'm still taking the vodka. I'm still smoking out in the parking lot. I'm still doing whatever it is that I need to do and being selfish. So the kids are growing up. I'm getting sick and tired of the single mom gig. So I go back to thinking, all right, I need a husband. So I go to the bar, like I met the first husband in, and I find this poor soul who absolutely drank the way I did, but he was really seemingly a nice guy, except he had the ability to drink like I did. And at this point, I'm drinking close to a half a gallon of vodka a day. And, you know, I had every kind of pill I could have had from my little nervous breakdown that I had earlier. So I got almost a decade under my belt of that and all this vodka. Vodka, why? Because vodka makes you black out. That was just my drink. And I could also bring it in sippy cups to games and, you know, all my mom of the year stuff that I was doing, the plays that my mom didn't go to, the little teacher conferences. If it was after 6 o'clock at night, it didn't matter, I was drinking. And, again, I thought that this was all okay because I could wait until 6 o'clock at night. There was really nothing pushing me to drink when I first woke up in the morning. I had to work, and I knew I couldn't work once I started drinking the vodka because I'm a true diehard blackout drinker. I like to black out, and I like to black out quick, and if I don't black out, I'm very upset about it. So, you know, I kept it cool during the day, and I went all out at night. Kids are getting older. They need to stay up later. They were kind of fighting me now. I'm going to bed at 6 o'clock. So I thought it was time to let them in on the fact that this is what I do. And if you have a problem with it, too bad. Go have your own family and tell me you could do it any better. And that's the kind of relationship that I had with my children for a while. You know, food on the table and going to these events. I coached softball for a year. I did it completely drunk. I still know nothing about it, but I don't know. I wrote in the book, and again, mom of the year. It was just unbelievable and heartbreaking to me at this point how disgusting that behavior was. Of course, I didn't think so at the time. So I meet this poor guy in the bar, and we get married, and he's got a good job. He's got some money in the bank, and he's got a house to sell so we can buy a bigger one. So I'm thinking, I scored. I took this man completely hostage. I absolutely had no interest in him except for the fact that he was going to save me from the single mom gig. He accepted my children, And that was big for me because I never dated anybody ever before that had children because I had three and I could barely tolerate them. So throwing more kids in the mix was just never my deal. And so I found this guy, single, and we got married. We did it big. We went to Disney. We had a beach wedding. Spent a fortune on it. And everybody seemingly was very happy. The inside of that household was a totally different story. Now, I was drinking openly from 5 o'clock on, because that's when work ended, and then fighting with my husband at night as we both proceeded to drink until oblivion, and we couldn't stand each other. So we fought a lot. The kids were scared. I didn't care. It didn't matter. I thought that they were getting everything that I never had in a big, beautiful house, and, you know, everything they wanted, they got, and so I thought I was doing pretty okay, except for these random breakout fights that were happening. And really, I didn't even notice that most of them was happening because I was in that blackout. I hear about them a lot now from the kids because they like to remind me on a regular basis why I should never go back to drinking. And they do a good job at it. And so I lived with him for 4 years. That's how long we were married. We were together 7 total. And those 4 years just went down, and it went down in a slow, painful kind of way. I blew out my back in about a year before I got here and got not really introduced to Percocet because I'd taken them for fun before, but I got put on them for the pain, and the pain, so excruciating as it was, I have 6 herniated discs and I can't walk, and, you know, so now I'm going to the emergency room on a regular basis, getting the really good stuff, coming home, taking the Percocet, realizing just how much better the vodka was with the combination of that and Percocet and Xanax. So I was feeling like a seemingly happy girl as the time has gone on until I couldn't hold my job anymore. I was completely incapable of holding my job at this point. I lost it. I went on unemployment. I ended up at the Cleveland Clinic with some undiagnosable neurological problem. Now, the doctors up there said, I went up with my brother the first time, and now we're in the Cleveland Clinic, so this is big time, right? All I'm thinking is they must have really good stuff here, because if they have it in the emergency room, the Cleveland Clinic's the place to be. So I'm up there and totally lying about my alcohol use, and, you know, my brother says, you got to come clean with one of these doctors. As we're sitting in the room, in between visits, drinking vodka together, because this is the brother that, you know, he's got it, but that's his business. So we're in this room, and we're getting annihilated, and he's like, you have to tell the doctors. So I go in and I tell this one guy, because now I'm having MRI after MRI, they can't find anything, and I'm like, you know, that's, you know, social drinking spiel we give the doctors, you know. Yeah, I'm a social drinker. I'm very, very social. Well, I fessed up, kind of. Told him I was drinking a bottle of wine a night. Didn't mention the vodka. That was going down with the bottle of wine a night because that was also a nice combination with the mix. And he told me that, you know, this is probably alcoholic neuropathy. And I'm like, no way. Like, it can't possibly be. So I quit drinking. For 6 weeks, I quit drinking. And I went back to his doctor and said, see, I stopped. I'm totally okay with stopping. I did it. I stopped when I was pregnant all 3 times, and my kids were back to back. So there was a big time frame of me not drinking. And all these little time frames that came after when I had to do it because I had to do it, I'm thinking, I'm convincing myself that there's absolutely no way I could have a problem if I could stop drinking for 6 weeks at the drop of a dime because somebody dared to tell me that my problem might be alcohol. So I did it, all proud of myself, posting it up on Facebook that I haven't had a drink in 6 weeks. Now my Facebook, off the hook, you know, I'm like finding Xanax in the carpet, posting it on Facebook. And so how I got here was, besides that story, is I'm on Facebook and I'm all kinds of addicted to this farm bill. And now, the true addict that I am, I had 5 farms. I was totally obsessed with this game. I'm like a lunatic, like I was with everything. And I met somebody online who was as addicted to Farmville as I was. And he lived out in California. And I thought I had fallen in love with him. Now, I'm miserable in my marriage. Everything's falling apart. I don't have a job. And I'm living in this complete fantasy world. Because now, I'm drinking as soon as I get up, because I don't have a job. And I'm going throughout the day, passing out on and off. I don't even know what's going on with my kids at this point. Very grateful. I look at it now as totally God in my life, because we were in this little small town, and they could get to school. And they, you know, because I was completely incapable of doing this at this point. I could not take them to school. I could not get them up in the morning. To this day, they get themselves up in the morning, because I could never get them up in the morning. So I have this little farm bill affair, and this was the total end of my marriage, because I wasn't really quiet about any of this. I guess I kind of probably wanted my husband to know, because at this point I'm hating him. I'm hating myself. I'm hating my life. The house didn't matter anymore. I was really, like, minimally caring about what's going on with the kids. Terrible mother. Absolutely. All the abuse that I endured as a child was absolutely nothing compared to what I did to my children. I was totally not there for them. I wasn't there for anybody. I couldn't even be there for myself. So I end up one night at a graduation party, 8th grade graduation. I'm at this party, and my kids are there. And I'm not drinking so heavy, because I got to go home, which is right in a little tiny town of Alpha, but I figure I'll go maybe get a little buzz on there and go take it home and finish up. And I ended up that night in a park with somebody that I should not have been with. Left my kids at this party, went to the park, in the middle of the park, like out in the open, in the parking lot. And cops pull up, and they're like, "What are you drinking?" I'm like, "Does it matter? Like, I'm parked. I'm not even driving. Like, you know, and you're not allowed to be in the park after dark." I didn't really take that very seriously ever until that night. And I was in that park with somebody I should not have been with. And they took me in. I got arrested. I don't know how. I blew a .09, because I don't think I could have blown that on any given morning, but I did. And I very quickly went from being pissed off at the cops for being such jerks. The next day, you know, my husband had to come pick me up from the police station. They were kind of cool. They didn't tell him what was going on or what I was doing or who I was with. Not that it wasn't in the paper, but, you know, I got off that night. And the whole next day, I sat pretty much on my back patio with my head in my hands and ate. What disgusted me the most was my behavior that night. Like, because I wasn't in a blackout. I didn't have that excuse to use for it. I was completely disgusted with myself, and I wanted to die. I didn't know how my life had gotten there. It got so bad. And I guess everybody has that moment before they come in here where they realize it's all just gone too far, you know. And I didn't really know what was going to happen. I had absolutely no idea. If you would have told me that day, I absolutely would never, ever, ever have believed it. But I was sitting there with my head in my hand and trying to figure out what I was going to do. And Farm Bill guy calls me and says, "Why don't you go to an AA meeting?" See, it turns out he was in AA. And I just didn't care. Like, I didn't think I knew anybody in AA. Turns out when you sober up a little and you start listening to other people and not just yourself, you know, like, I found out I have an aunt that has 25 years in this program, and me and all my little escapades on Facebook, and I leave it all out there. I actually encourage my girls to go look at how I was, because I don't think any of them truly believe how bad I was looking at me now. But a lot of people were worried about me and afraid to say anything, and the ones who did say anything, I'd have been completely pissed off at, and I wouldn't have listened anyway. So I decided that night I was going to go to an AA meeting. Now, I went online and found a little town alpha meeting, and I figured, okay, cool. Everybody here is an alcoholic. I should know everybody. I go walking into that meeting, and it's really primarily guys. I knew I saw something about men's meetings and women's meetings and stuff, so I'm thinking maybe I hit up a men's meeting, but really I got to get something done here, so I'm going to go in. And it turned out that it was a regular speaker discussion meeting, and I went in, and I guess, like, I saw step one, on a little plaque. They didn't have it up on the wall, and I knew that I had that step, and it really didn't take a lot for me to realize that I was absolutely powerless and my life was totally unmanageable. I knew it from the night before, and I knew I had no way of stopping, and that's exactly why I went to that meeting. I knew I had to stop. Not necessarily did I want to stop, but I did want to die, so I knew I had to stop, and I did not know how I was going to do that forever, because I've done it enough where I knew that if I picked up, I was going to go harder and harder and harder, because that was one of my patterns. So I go in there and meet a great bunch of people. I heard a few things, one being that there's a solution to all this. I was kind of still messed up and not really hearing anything. I just heard there was a solution. I asked them where it's at. They handed me a big book and said, read this, go to meetings, get a sponsor. Now, I just stopped taking everything that one day. All of that, I just stopped. Half a gallon of vodka a day, some wine and tequila mixed in there, Xanax, Percocet, just everything stopped. Was not going to do it anymore. So I detoxed pretty good. I did not go to detox, and I did not go to rehab. And at that time, I really, really wish I had. But now I know that I came in here on my knees, completely hopeless, with the gift of desperation. And I needed that. I absolutely needed that. I'm very lucky I didn't die. I don't recommend it to anybody to do it that way. If I have a woman that I'm working with now that's like that, I gladly take her to detox. It's just not medically safe, but this is my experience and how I did it. Nobody even really said anything about it, and I really just didn't know anything about it, so I cried and threw up for a couple of weeks, and I went to a meeting, and I went to 2 meetings. By day 3 or 4, I'm going to like 4 meetings, and I went to this woman's meeting, because they told me I had to go to a women's meeting. They told me I needed a woman sponsor. And both these things I was completely and totally against, because I could not stand women. I could not stand women because, as I came to find out, I could not stand anything about them, because I was exactly like that. Anything I didn't like in you was all the behavior that I had inside of me. I went to this women's meeting because it was suggested, and I absolutely was told that if I was willing to do this, and willing to go to any lengths, and willing to do what people told me to do, that I would recover from this. I had absolutely no desire to be sober. I didn't want to be sober. Sober, to me, was misery. I couldn't function sober, and not only because of the physical addiction of this. I did not know how to act. I didn't know how to respond. I didn't know how to cope. I didn't know how to deal. And, you know, that goes way back to my childhood and how early all this started. So I go to this woman's meeting, and Day three. And I'm detoxing bad. I'm sweating, I'm throwing up, I'm crying, and I'm angry. So very angry, because this is just me dealing with untreated alcoholism. Angriest person probably you will have ever met, if you met me when I first got here. And I go to this women's meeting, and I probably scared the hell out of these women. Like, I'm like, how do you get a sponsor? I keep hearing you got to get a sponsor. Oh, don't worry, you'll find the right one. And I'm like, what the hell does that mean? What are you talking about? Like, I can't go to any more of these meetings. You know, I'm going to these meetings, and all I want to do is drink. That's all I wanted to do, was leave those meetings. The more meetings I went to, the more meetings I wanted to drink after. And I was dying, and I knew I was not making it through that first weekend. And to feel like I was all willing to do everything on the first day and get to that first weekend and be like, I can't do this, I'm going to die. I went to this meeting in Clinton, and I was so hurting that day. I was just about in the fetal position outside this meeting, and God graced me that day with my sponsor. She saw me. She hadn't been to that meeting in years. And I woke up that morning for some reason thinking about tequila. And it turns out that that was her drink of choice. So she shows up. I'm crying in the corner, throwing up, sweating. And she said something in that meeting about working this program and doing these steps. And that she sat right next to me. I guess she knew when she got there that I was the reason why she had woke up that morning and said, oh, I should go to Race Street today. So before she even got to ask me, I begged her to be my sponsor. I said, I need somebody to show me how to do this. I have to do it fast, and I have to do it now, and I need to get rid of this because I had the obsession. I could not go a minute without thinking about it. I was dying inside, and really, I was very suicidal when I got here. So I was ready to go. And the only reason that I did not kill myself was because I knew what it was like losing a mom. I lost one twice. It was horrible both times. And I just didn't want my kids to experience that. But I also knew what kind of mom I had become. And I thought they'd be better off without me. I didn't know who was going to take care of them, but I figured anybody would be better than me at that point. And so I met my sponsor that day, and she sat outside with me on a swing, and we talked about how she sponsors, what she does, how she was brought through it, and if I was willing to do it, she tells me, which is what she was told. It's nothing, you know, all crazy. It is pretty simple that she could help me. And I believed her, because there she was. She had 11 years of sobriety at the time. She looked like the happiest person that I had ever met. She was at peace, and she seemed free. And I picked up on this within a couple of hours of talking to her. She spent a lot of time with me that day, and she told me a little bit about herself. And I identified it with it because she was had the three kids, and she was the same kind of mom, and she had the same addictions, and she, you know, we just clicked, and that was completely God. So she told me as soon as I sobered up a bit, got a little bit of a clearer head, she'd start taking me through. She said, she told me what to read in the book, and that we'd sit down in about a week, and we'd start going through the work. And I was like, okay, here we go. This is going to do it, right? So I read the book three times. I had absolutely no idea what I just read. But I'm a textbook girl, so I'm thinking, all right, I can read this, I can do it, you know, I'll get there. She'll be all proud of me because I know what I'm doing, and this can be over real fast. And I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I identified with a lot of it. I did. I mean, absolutely, you know. But I was like, where is the work in here? You know, and we all read how it works at most of our meetings when we walk in, and I'm like, they're telling us how it works, and okay, so why is everybody wondering how it works? So I go, and she sits me down, and the first sitting we went through 1, 2, and 3. I take my women that I work with through it this way now. It's conceding to this disease and making a couple of basic decisions everybody frets over them. I'm not entirely sure why. I did believe in God because I was Catholic and brought up that way, and I did not disbelieve that he existed. I was extremely resentful that he had given me the life that I was given, as if it was all his fault. So that's the way my relationship with God was when I got here. So I certainly wasn't trusting in turning everything that I do and believe over to him. So this was my one misgiving when I got here, but my sponsor told me, you just need to be willing to believe that this is going to happen if you go through with this process. I said I was willing to do anything she told me, and she said, well, then get a notebook, because you're going to write your inventory. I was not afraid to do this inventory. I was afraid not to do this inventory. She told me that this is the part that a lot of people get stuck. Nobody wants to write it. Nobody wants to put this stuff down. I was still living with my ex-husband, so I was very, very fearful that he was going to find it. So I did it as fast as I could, and I did it as thorough as I could. And most of a five-subject notebook later, it was done. And I took it to her, and I said, all right, I got to do this, because my ex-husband's going to find it, and he's going to kill me. So we sat down and we did our fifth step. And I say ours because, I mean, that fifth step was the most liberating experience of my life. To actually sit down and, you know, the way we do it and the way I was taught and the way she was brought through it was we have those sheets, the worksheets that come out of the big book. And, you know, she says, you do column one and two, you know, who and what you're mad at and why. Don't make it a novel. Just basically go down and do that. And then me and you are going to do three and four in the fifth step, third and fourth column. I needed somebody to do it with me like that. If I had tried to do those other two columns by myself, I'd have been delusional throughout the whole process because nothing was my fault. I didn't do anything to these people. They just pissed me off for no reason. So, you know, in that way, she explained to me, and she turned it all around and showed me a different way to look at it. And this is where the liberation happened for me in this program, you know, to see what my part was in all of this and how selfish and self-centered I had been the entire time. Sure, there's things from my childhood that I was resentful at, and it wasn't my fault. But there's ways of dealing with this. This is where we start getting the tools to live and exist a normal life with everybody else around us who isn't afflicted by this disease and who doesn't understand anything that we go through and how we see it. And I needed to be shown that. It took her 15 hours, but I saw it. So, you know, that was a long weekend and one of the best, most incredible experiences of my life. I never felt so free. At that point, I did not regret my past. You know, I can now look back at it and learn from it, and I know now my patterns of behavior, so I don't ever have to live that way again. It really was that simple. It was hard to do it and to face it, but really, to be free of it, there's nothing better. The fifth step promise in our book, where we can look the world in the eye again and be able to exist. Every promise in this book has come true for me, every single one of them. We did six and seven immediately after the fifth step, after I was instructed to take my hour and go back and reflect on what I've done so far. And six and seven was where the spiritual aspect turned around for me in this program. You know, I was already starting to feel different. People were starting to see I was different. I was starting to react different to situations, and I was feeling better. I was feeling free. Not better because I was removed of the drugs and alcohol, which you do feel better. I needed to do it fast because I would have become complacent. And I can't feel that way even today, because once I start getting complacent, my thinking starts going back exactly to where it was in the first place. So I knew at this point that I needed a spiritual, an entire psychic change, a spiritual awakening. This is where it began for me in 6 and 7, and I decided that I was capable and willing to turn everything over to the care of God. I asked him to remove my defects of character, and I checked them every day to make sure that I'm not going back to where I was. So that's where it all really turned around for me there. I put God and the church in my resentment inventory. So when we got to 8 and 9 and we were doing my amends, setting up the list, you know, it's like, okay, now I got to make these amends. And God and the church was on there. So I went to my church, and I had gotten an annulment from my first husband so that I could marry second husband in the church, because I thought maybe my marriage is really crappy because I didn't get married in the church. I got married on the beach. And that's exactly what I was thinking when I did it. And I know now that that was really not the right way of looking at it, but it seemed good at the time. It seemed like a great idea. So I go back to the church because, I mean, really, I went in there with my story. And, you know, the priest was like, oh my goodness, you know, poor thing, you know, and I had all the sympathy in the world. The church paid for my annulment. You know, I went down and touched in, did what I had to do, got the same response. I was a great actor when I was in my prime, you know. I had everybody feeling sorry for me. Going through this process, you know, I realized just how low my behavior had gone and how low I had sunk into this. And I had to go make this amends. I went down to the church and I ended up talking to the Monsignor for 45 minutes. We talked. We talked about addiction. We talked about alcohol. And I didn't go in the little box because I really wasn't looking to confess. I didn't think, like, I didn't know how to do this. So we sat in his office, and I was happy that he smoked cigarettes because we smoked cigarettes the whole time. And had a really long, deep conversation about my relationship with God and how it had changed and what I was doing. And he told me a lot of stories about priests and relatives and people who were afflicted by this, and he actually knew a lot about it. And it was, he gave me absolution at the end of it, and I thought I was going to be saying Hail Marys and the Rosary and everything for 10 days to make up for all the time and everything I had done. But he handed me a movie, and it was called Don't Cry Tomorrow. It's like a 1950-something movie about an actress who becomes addicted to alcohol, ends up in AA. Like, if you watch this movie, like, I sat down with my sponsor and one of the girls that I was hanging with at the time, and this disease has never changed. You know, this is in black and white, just like our book written so long ago, and how we can all still identify with things that are in it, and the physical and mental and spiritual aspects of it. And it was pretty intense. It was one of my best amends. My daughter, who I thought was going to be the easiest, because we listed it from easiest to hardest, though I'd be a pro by the time I got to the harder ones. And I thought my daughter's was going to be the easiest because she's the oldest and she's the most practical. So I just figured she's going to be proud of me and we're going to be good. Now, mind you, I think I have like 30 days now. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm going through this work, I'm doing everything I got to do. And, you know, 30 days of sobriety, she doesn't have a clue what I'm doing and how this work is really affecting me. I'm sure they saw some changes, especially in the anger. But, you know, I sat down, I told her what I had to tell her, and she says to me, well, I'm so glad you're sober now. I'd like you to stay that way because maybe now you'll remember the conversations we have. And that was like getting a punch in the stomach like no other I could imagine. Like, I really knew the depths of what I've done, most especially to my children. So I go along the process of making these amends. In the meantime, I'm doing 10, 11, and 12. My sponsor actually starts us off kind of, I guess the most difficult ones, right after the fourth step inventory and the fifth step. She's like, you might want to start doing 10, you know, watching this every day so that you don't end up with no notebook. So that 10 step, one of the most important things to me now, I try to do it every night. Right before I go to sleep, I run through my head those questions that we need to ask ourselves. Was I being selfish today? Was I only thinking about myself? All those things that got me all built up to where I was when I got here. I need to keep that in check. We all need to keep that in check, because maintenance and the actions we take from that point on are the most important part of this program. 11, prayer and meditation. I have issues with sitting still. Meditation, never been easy for me. I was directed to do that third step prayer every morning, and I've done it since I've been directed to do it, and seven steps since we got to it. It starts my whole day, puts me in the frame of mind where I need to be, so that I know that I have to do what I need to do to be useful to my fellows and to God, so that I can go and experience that 12th step that we all get to when we do this work. And that is absolutely the highlight of my program, working with other women, taking them through this work, and having them see and feel that liberation. Taking another woman through the fifth step and watching that light come on in their eyes when they realize and they see everything in a different way is the most amazing and remarkable blessing that I've been given out of this program. There's no words to begin to describe hearing somebody's fifth step. It's an absolute honor. And I've been blessed to do it a few times, and it's just surreal. I know that feeling that they had. It's a beautiful thing to see it happen to somebody else. None of us could be here and exist here and stay here without somebody reaching their hand out and taking us through that work. If you haven't done the work, if you're hesitant about doing the work, I suggest, in my experience, the way I was brought through this, you cannot do this fast enough. Because once you get through it and you start practicing these principles in all your affairs, and you have the experiences that this program actually brings to us through the program of recovery, which is the 12 steps, my whole life has been transformed. It has not been band-aided up and neosporined and patched. And now I'm living the same way I was, just better. My whole life has changed. Like I said, every promise that is offered in this book and says is going to happen has come true in my life. Today, I have a beautiful relationship with my children. They are trusting of me. They know. They're very accepting of this program. All that time I didn't give to them, and now I have to put into this program because I know what I have to do to stay sober. They understand it. They've come to see me speak. They've come to meetings with me. You know, they've incorporated it a little bit into their lives. And with three of them, I have no idea which ones, how many, if any, of them are going to be afflicted by this. I completely believe that there's a genetic aspect to this. I have no reason to think that it doesn't, because my whole family is this way. So in one way or another, in one sense. So, I went back to work fairly early. I was capable of doing it again. Now I can really take care of my kids. I did not even have 90 days before the first woman that I met, that I sponsored, asked me to take her through the work. And afraid I was, I went to my sponsor, and I'm like, she asked me to sponsor, I can't do that, right? She's like, you're not a therapist, you're not a life coach, you're going to do what I did with you, you're going to take it through the book, and you're going to show her what to do, and she's going to do it or not. Big bonus, you're going to stay sober. You're going to stay happy. You're going to stay free. She has not been wrong yet. She's been absolutely right on everything that she's told me that's come directly out of this book. you know, we all have our personal lives and our personal conflicts, and the tools that we're given in this program to get through them, remarkable experience. You know, I really, honestly, all that time I didn't think I knew how to function sober. It was because I seriously didn't know how to function sober. I had no, everything was delusional. Everything was resentment and anger and feeling sorry for myself. All that's turned around. All those nights that promises all come true. I have a beautiful relationship today with a wonderful man. His son has now come to live with us. I could not be happier. I could not be happier for him. I couldn't be happier for my children. The way the family is blended has been beautiful. This is something that I would not even have conceived of doing because I was so selfish. I couldn't even tolerate my own kids. And now to be able to do this and be happy about it, it's a completely different life that I've been given. My relationship with God today is, I leave everything to him. I have no control over this. I don't try to fool myself. And if I do start trying to fool myself, I look to somebody to either back me up and tell me you're fooling yourself. And that's part of the fellowship that's important. And having people in your life that are recovered. You know, it's great to go out. I know this now. And to help women and to help them see this. We need to have a base of recovered people in our lives too. Because we kind of have to back each other up. And that's the beauty of the fellowship. All the service work, all the time you put in, it's all a beautiful thing. And I can't say enough about this program. It absolutely saved my life. It saved the lives of my children. And I'm totally happy today. Happy, joyous, and free. And, thank you so much for having me here. It's been an honor.